From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The right to assemble, to petition the government, freedom of religion, all cherished liberties in America. But what limits can be imposed upon these when public health is at risk? In a pandemic, what can government tell us to do? And what are the limits of that authority? Well, in this country, where the states have a lot of power, the response often depends upon where you live. That's what we're exploring today in The Exchange. And listeners, let's get you in on this. What rights do you think governments and individuals should have during this time? What limitations feel reasonable to you and which do not? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, you can join us with an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are John Grabe, director of the Rudman Center for Justice, Leadership, and Public Service, and a professor of law at the UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law, and Alan Greenblatt, senior staff writer for Governing, a news outlet that covers state and local government. He joins us from St. Louis. Welcome to you both. And John Grabe, let's start with you. Legal experts have said law and public policy have a long history of deference to intrusive action by public health authorities, especially during deadly infectious disease outbreaks. I'm wondering, John, how much the founders did have to say about this, because I think there were a lot of communicable diseases back then.
Well, you know, as like so many things, there's nothing really explicitly written into the Constitution that addresses, you know, the question of whether or not courts should, you know, defer more in certain circumstances to political authorities. And if we were, you know, if it were possible to go back in time and poll the framers, I think we'd find that, you know, there's probably the same, there would have been the same diversity of viewpoints among them that we see today. But you're right, you know, there's this really fundamental question that's pervading just about every area of law that's implicated by COVID right now. And that's the question of what role should the judiciary play in, you know, sort of curbing or overseeing the political branches in emergency circumstances when they're trying to deal with a pandemic involving a highly communicable disease. As you might imagine, judges are not terribly eager for the most part to jump in with both feet. And there's a really lively debate about whether or not the question ought to be analyzed in the ordinary way that it would when a lawsuit is brought, bringing a claim that there's been some sort of constitutional violation, or whether a much more deferential standard of review ought to be applied by courts, federal and state around the country, when somebody brings a challenge to some aspect of government's response to COVID.
Right, and that quote I read, you know, again, law and public policy have a long history of deference to intrusive action. What does that deference mean, John?
Well, the deference would mean that if a lawsuit is brought in a court saying, for example, that a, you know, a stay-at-home order is violating my constitutional rights, my right, you know, as you mentioned in the introduction, to assemble, or my right to freely exercise my religious beliefs. Ordinarily, courts would look at the law and would decide if, in fact, it, you know, was placing some sort of curtailment on religious freedom or assembly rights, for example. It would decide, you know, whether or not there's a compelling interest in curtailing rights, and whether or not the measures taken are very, very narrowly tailored so that there's no more of an intrusion on rights than is strictly necessary. That's the ordinary test that would apply. Some courts are suggesting, however, that even that test, which is itself, you know, has some deference elements built into it, that involves too much court oversight in the course of an emergency, and that courts really need to defer to political authorities, both as a matter of institutional competence, but also for purposes of giving political authorities room to maneuver and room to breathe to address emergency situations.
Wow. So we're all getting a lesson in checks and balances as we did when we were younger. What do you think, Alan? How are you hearing this being discussed as you cover these issues around the country?
Well, you know, we've been here before. None of us have been here in our lifetime. We're 102 years past the Spanish flu pandemic. But the country has had other disease outbreaks in the 19th century, pretty common with cholera, and yellow fever and things we don't particularly worry about so much anymore. And really public health started at a local level. New York was the first, New York City, and then in Boston. And there were these outbreaks in those dense cities as we're seeing now. And the health authorities over time grew more power and at the state level as well. And in 1905, and I'm sorry to cite a Supreme Court case when you have a law professor on the line.
That's okay.
There was a case, Jacobson versus Massachusetts, which involved a challenge against a mandatory vaccination law in Cambridge. The Supreme Court ruled that the government did have the right to enforce that law, that individual liberties had to be subsumed by the collective goodwill, that public health was a legitimate reason to squash what would normally be seen as individual liberties. The court did say that because it was for a specific purpose, it was not arbitrary or oppressive. So that was 1905. That case is still being cited even last month. But the courts in general have taken a more expansive view of individual liberties ever since 1905. But that is sort of the reigning case, is my understanding. And we've had a number of lawsuits. Probably just about every state has had lawsuits where the governor's authority has been challenged over the past few weeks, sometimes by state legislators, sometimes by business owners, sometimes just by private individuals. I think it was just last week, and there was a Pennsylvania case, and this U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear it, which was an indication that they sided with the governor, that the governor did have sweeping powers in a pandemic like this.
Wow. It'd be interesting to hear from you, Alan, the sort of substance of some of these cases that are being brought around the country. Are people filing lawsuits because they feel like their freedom to assemble has been violated, or their freedom of religion, or what, Alan?
Well, it's just about everything. I don't think there's so many cases based on freedom of assembly, and people are still protesting, right? There certainly have been instances, like in Kansas, just before Easter, the governor there, Laura Kelly, said, you know, she was not going to allow in-person church attendance, and there was sort of a legislative review board. You know, some states have, the governors have standing emergency powers. They can be referred to anytime there's an emergency. In some states, like Kansas, they gave the governor new authority back in March to deal with this pandemic. And in Kansas, they created this legislative review board to say, to sort of give oversight on the governor's decisions. And the legislative review board tried to overturn the governor's ruling in terms of church attendance. And that case went to the state Supreme Court, and the court sided with the governor and said, basically, you know, the legislators had created this extra role for themselves. They would have to pass a new law to question their own law that they had passed. They couldn't just sort of arbitrarily veto parts of it, so to speak. So again, the governor's authority was upheld.
Wow, interesting. Well, I want to remind our listeners that you can join us. We're talking about rights, individual liberties in an era of a public health emergency. Let's hear from you. What rights do you think governments and individuals should have during this time? What limitations feel okay to you, which do not? We'd love your thoughts. Again, our phone number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. We got a Facebook comment from Carla who says, when did unelected officials get the authority to suspend the Constitution? Now, both of you, I wish Carla had written a little bit more about which unelected authorities, but this has come up. John, it's come up in terms of public health authorities. They are not elected. Our Dr. Chan here, for example, in the state isn't elected. Maybe she's talking about individual businesses that might mandate the wearing of masks. Just tell me when you have heard this idea come up, John, unelected officials suspending the Constitution, as Carla puts it.
Well, you're right to point to officials who are, you know, appointed to their office as part of, you know, the administrative structure of, you know, the federal government or the states. The other context in which you frequently hear, you know, objections to decisions made by unelected leaders involves decisions by federal courts, because once somebody becomes a federal judge, they hold their office for life. And so, you know, it could refer, I suppose, to either context. You know, what's inherent in the question is, you know, to suspend our Constitution. What's inherent in the question is a broadly held notion that our constitutional rights are fixed and widely understood. But I would take some issue with that. I think that even in ordinary times, all of our constitutional rights are qualified. For example, our right to freedom of speech is as fundamental a right as we hold. But built into the analysis when a freedom of speech claim is brought to a court is the idea that in compelling circumstances, the government might be able to curtail speech rights no more than necessary. And that idea really pervades constitutional analysis. So really, it's understood that the Constitution is a document that is not rigid and that is not ontological and that does not, confer rights that are fixed and whose scope is not affected by context. Context matters in terms of defining what our constitutional rights are.
Oh, that's interesting. And of course, you're right. Judges are unelected in New Hampshire. So some people might see unelected judges as suspending the Constitution. In other states, they are elected. What do you think about this comment, Alan? And have you heard it repeated in other states?
There are challenges, not just against the governors, but some of the appointed officials. For instance, in Ohio, the health director there has a good amount of authority to shut things down. And legislators have introduced bills to take those powers away. And then there are, there certainly is concern for constitutional rights. We've been mainly talking about sort of First Amendment rights, but in Texas, gun shops were not considered essential to remain open during sort of early stages of their stay at home period there. And the governor and state attorney general intervened and said that people did indeed have a right, Second Amendment right, to access to firearms. So in that case, they made an effort to uphold the constitutional rights. So there's always this give and take, as John has suggested.
All right. Well, Carla, thank you for writing in. Again, you can use Facebook like she did, or you can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. John Grabe, it was really interesting to hear Alan describe a moment ago the wide variety in authority that individual governors had state by state. And John, it makes me wonder what the best way is to view the powers of states versus the federal government in a public health crisis. It sounds like the states are kind of taking charge here.
Yeah, absolutely. This whole idea of federalism. Federalism is the term we use to describe, the separation of powers between our federal government and the states. And it's captured probably most directly in the 10th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which says that all powers not given, in so many words, it says all powers not given to the federal government created by the federal constitution are reserved to the states and to the people. So the idea is that, the federal government is a government of limited and defined and enumerated powers. And if the constitution doesn't give power to the federal government, such power is by default reserved to the states. We call that the general police power, the idea that the states have a general power to legislate, to preserve the health and safety of people within its territory. Many of our biggest constitutional battles in our history have been fights about, the scope of the federal government's power. There's also a division of power horizontally among the various branches of the federal and state governments, the legislative branch, the executive branch, and the judicial branch. And we're seeing arguments along every clash point right now. We're seeing disputes about the extent of state power vis-a-vis the federal government. We're seeing also disputes about the power of the governors and power of the president vis-a-vis the legislature. I teach an introductory constitutional law course. I actually gave a continuing legal education seminar last weekend showing how the coronavirus would really permit me to teach the entirety of that course right now, just given disputes that are breaking out.
Right.
This question of where power lies is really the fundamental question of constitutional law. And that question is being raised, as Alan says, in virtually every context right now. The context of federal versus state, and you know the context of state versus state, and then within states and within the federal government, the context of legislative power versus presidential power versus judicial power.
Sure, and in some states we're seeing state versus local, where towns want to do one thing and the state government says, no, you can't do that. Alan, I want your thoughts on that as well, but I'd like to go first to a caller. Dave in Raymond is on the line. Hi, Dave. You're on the exchange. Go ahead. Good. Go ahead.
It's really, thank you for taking my call. So I guess I agree with the governor having, you know, emergency power in like an earthquake or a tornado or a forest fire. But now that we've decided that a cold or a pandemic is, you know, we can declare a state of emergency, I worry where we're going to draw the line. Like next year's flu season, are we suddenly going to have to quarantine because there's too many flu cases? Or if there's a, you know, a spike in Lyme disease cases, are we suddenly going to have to stay at home in the Northeast or avoid the woods? I feel like we've opened the door to declare a stay-at-home order for all kinds of things.
So how far will these so-called health emergencies go? You know, it's an interesting question. And Alan, I wonder if you've heard this come up elsewhere in your coverage, people saying, look, this using the pandemic as a reason to impose emergency powers could be extended to other health crises, perhaps not as serious as Dave is saying.
Yeah, I find this to be a specious argument. I think this is what emergency powers are for. I think we've had arbitrary declarations of emergency in the past, so we're not used to this. This is the first time in American history where there have been federally declared disasters in every state in the union. when Dave talks about earthquakes and hurricanes and wildfires, those are site-specific places. That's what we're used to in terms of disaster. We're not used to a disaster hitting the entire country, and in fact, the entire world. but we have had, as I was saying earlier, in the past, we have had health outbreaks. We've had cholera epidemics and yellow fever epidemics. And that's when these powers are invoked. And note that it hasn't happened for over 100 years. We did have stay-at-home orders in places during the Spanish flu epidemic. We've had some other major flu epidemics in the past where tens of thousands of people died in 1957 and so forth. But I don't, you know, there is the danger that governors could supersede their authority. And if there was, say, a bad flu season or a Lyme outbreak, that people would object. There would then be enormous political pressure, as we're seeing now when we're here on a day when we're passing 80,000 deaths nationwide. People are still somehow dismissing this as not a serious emergency. So yes, everything that is done sets a potential precedent. Every time powers are taken by an executive, it's likely the next executive will want to exercise them. But you know, we're still in this one. I think there's plenty of time to worry about the next set of circumstances.
Well, Dave, I appreciate the question. And next time I talk to one of the state's public health doctors, I will try to remember to pose that. Just the idea of this is serious, but could other health crises be considered as serious to merit imposing emergency powers, or where do you draw those lines? So thank you for calling in, Dave, with that. And Glenn is joining us from Hancock. Hi, Glenn. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, good morning. I taught a civics course that we explored the very concept of legislating behavior. And I gave the example that, the government draws a white line in the road and it guides the people and for their safety. Now, you can go over the white line anytime you want. So convention and agreement is what really keeps us in line. And in a country that has declared their independence, as I said, legislating behavior is not very popular. At the same time, we're challenged here, and I think the strong-arm approach is not as good as the white-line approach that we have to, and how do we get people, to join in to this convention, this agreement?
So, Glenn, as somebody who used to teach civics, how well do you see us doing it, sort of maintaining that adherence to the white line, more or less? Glenn, are you still there? Okay, I guess we lost Glenn. It was good to hear from him. John, that's a question for you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you know, with the adoption of some of these orders, there's really a double layer of security that's built in. I mean, the, you know, many of the orders around the country are not mandatory, you know, or there's no explicit enforcement mechanism attached to them. And then sitting on top of that, executive branch officials have inherent discretion of how, you know, how rigid they're going to be in enforcing orders and enforcing the law generally. And, you know, as Alan pointed out before, we expect that public opinion will curb our officials. And, you know, and so, you know, the governors who are issuing these orders, they want to be reelected. Many of them may want to, you know, move on eventually to federal office or to some higher office too. And so they are going to be responsive to political pressure. So I think, I mean, I think Glenn makes an excellent point. And I think actually, you know, what's been happening here in New Hampshire is an example of, you know, a whole, our governor has issued, you know, several orders. And my understanding though, is that they're being enforced with a very, very light touch. And, you know, that's a matter of political decision-making too. You know, how harshly, how strictly and how loosely are we going to enforce the, you know, the directives that are issued. So there's a lot of play in the joints. And, you know, and again, courts are there as a backup to take a second look when political authorities invoke emergency powers or adopt extraordinary means of dealing with some pressing public problem.
Oh, Glenn, thank you for the call. And coming up, we will talk about the position that many police around the country find themselves in, enforcing public health orders. We'll keep taking your questions as well. So join us with a phone call, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, government power, civil liberties, and COVID-19. We're exploring the rights and limitations of government and individuals during a public health emergency. Exchange listeners, tell us what you see. Do you think governors are overstepping their authority or finding the right balance? What about individuals? What are you seeing among other members of the public in terms of their rights and their responsibilities? Send us an email. That's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. We're talking with John Grabe, director of the Rudman Center for Justice, Leadership, and Public Service, and a professor of law at the UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law. Also, Alan Greenblatt, senior staff writer for Governing, a news outlet that covers state and local governments. You can hear him discussing emergency powers on NHPR's Civics 101, and there's a link to that episode on our website as well. And Alan, in some states, local communities have wanted to take another approach than the governor, either clamping down more than the governor wanted or loosening up more. We've been talking about sort of a tension between the federal and state governments. What about between state governments and cities and towns?
Yeah, we have certainly seen that from the very beginnings. You know, the response to the pandemic has seemed partisan, with Democrats being more aggressive and Republicans being less restrictive, but over time they've kind of converged. They follow similar policies. You don't see a tremendous amount of difference really between the states, although there is variation. But early in the pandemic, we saw mainly in southern states like Georgia and Florida, governor's orders superseding local governments. So there you had mostly Democratic-led larger cities and counties wanting to restrict movement, close beaches and things like that. And governors stepped in and said that that the localities could not have stricter regulations than the state had in place. And now that we're sort of at the opposite end, where you have states, you know, mostly Republican-led states being quicker to open things up, but still, again, Democrats taking mostly a similar approach. Now you do have, though, still some Democratic-led states with restrictions in place and localities chafing at that. in California and Pennsylvania and states like that, where you have local officials, county sheriffs, district attorneys, people like that saying, we're not going to enforce these laws, or our county is now open for business, things like that. So over the past decade, we've seen a lot of preemption of local authority by the states. And that same dynamic of tension between localities and states is certainly playing out now.
Wow. So in some states, Alan, a local community might say, we really want to keep this beach closed so people don't flock here. And the state has said, no, you got to open it up.
That's correct. There were beaches that were closed in Georgia that reopened after the governor put in his shelter in place order, which allowed beaches to be open. And we were talking earlier about how heavily these things are enforced. We've had counties where the health department, once things close and the sheriff says, I refuse to enforce it. I've heard of examples of counties where the health department made such an announcement and the sheriff did not want to enforce, and they had backstage negotiations. It was a triumph just to get the sheriff not to say he was not going to enforce it. There was still going to be no enforcement, but they didn't want to have conflicting public signals from the office holders. Because, you know, the caller before the break, Glenn, made a good point. You know, how much can you regulate this behavior and insist on it versus persuade people? And in the different states, whether they're strict stay-at-home orders or not, when the people track all the cell phone data, how much people are moving around, it's pretty much the same. People are acting pretty much the same, regardless of what the official orders are that are in place, because we're all seeing the same news coverage.
John, what about in New Hampshire? My understanding is cities and towns don't have that much say over what they can and can't do, that the state government is more powerful. Is that right?
Yeah, it's really, in each state, it's going to be a matter of state constitutional law.
Right.
And it kind of replicates, you know, the issue itself replicates the federalism issue we see in the national state level. You know, to what extent do state constitutions provide for local rule and home rule? And to what extent do they allow state authorities to preempt or override local officials with respect to issues? You know, in New Hampshire, we haven't seen that much, that at least that I've been aware of, in terms of conflicts. You know, I think it's kind of interesting to see, you know, how public opinion polls are showing that there's pretty broad support for the way in which the governor has handled things in this state. We don't see the same sort of bitter partisan division that we sometimes see with respect to other issues and in other places right now. And that may suggest that, you know, as a political matter, he's done a good job of managing this crisis while staying in step with local opinion about things.
I also want to ask both of you, John, you first, about interstate conflicts. This is an issue, especially in tourism-rich areas where some governors have been concerned about interstate travel. Residents are nervous about people coming in from virus hotspots into their states. And reflecting that concern, President Trump said at one point he was thinking about imposing travel restrictions on New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. This was a couple weeks ago. He backed off from that. John, were there constitutional problems with this, saying that you can't ban people from other states into coming into your state? I know this has been a big issue, especially here in New England, where the states are so small.
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely raises constitutional issues. Whether or not those constitutional issues go over the line and become constitutional violations, that's a separate question. But one of the principal reasons for adopting the federal constitution was because under our previous constitution, the Articles of Confederation, the states weren't playing nice with one another. They were engaged in protectionist economic behavior, such as imposing tariffs on goods made in other states. The framers, the founders, recognized that this was no way to run a railroad going forward. So there is a lot in the Constitution that places limits on the ability of states to discriminate against out-of-staters, to discriminate against products made out of state. And so when we see, for today, for example, in New Hampshire, my understanding is that the golf courses are reopening, but that only state residents can play at at New Hampshire golf courses. Now, in ordinary times, that sort of a restriction would be eyebrow raising in terms of the Constitution. I mean, there's Article 4 of the Constitution says that the privileges and immunities held by the citizens of all states should be respected, even when citizens of state A go into state B. The Commerce Clause has been interpreted to mean that states cannot discriminate or legislate or regulate in a way that advances in-state interests at the expense of out-of-state interests. But as I talked about before, these doctrines and these tests are not rigid and fixed. They are context-specific. And when circumstances dictate that state authorities have a little bit more power to, to take into account the dangers that are posed by people traveling in interstate commerce, courts will correspondingly relax their scrutiny and defer more to political authorities. But we're seeing all sorts of things being talked about that in ordinary circumstances would raise serious constitutional concerns.
Wow. So, John, under ordinary times, no, New Hampshire couldn't say if you're from New York, you can't come here, stop people with New York plates at the border. Can New Hampshire do that in these times?
Well, everything depends on context. So it would, again, whether or not that New Hampshire can do it, first of all, it would require somebody with authority to order such a measure. And then whether or not that measure would be upheld in court would really depend on the facts. I think courts are sensitive to the fact that, devolving into a bunch of protectionism, that undermines the overall public interest is no way forward. But if we're talking about a highly contagious virus and a pandemic and a need to keep people from moving about the country, well, enforcing limits at state boundaries makes some sense. And I think, I could envision scenarios where courts would say, this is a sufficient emergency for us to suspend the operation of the usual rules and to permit political authorities to turn people away at the border or ask people to quarantine themselves as they come into a state.
Wow. Alan, how much has this gone on? Again, especially in areas where the states are smaller, like New England, and there's a lot of interstate travel.
Well, I think about a month ago, the governor of Rhode Island, Gina Raimondo, said she was going to stop people with New York plates. And Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York objected to that. And Raimondo said, well, we won't do that, but we'll stop everybody with any out-of-state plate. So she wasn't discriminating specifically against New Yorkers, but decided to take a hard line. And it's a very thorny question, I think, for your part of the world where there are so many summer homes. Do people get to use property that they own if they are residents of another state? We've been talking about impingement on liberty, but it's much lighter here than in other countries where you have actual quarantines, where you have, in China, people unable to leave Wuhan, where you had people in northern Italy unable to leave. There's certainly questions about the effectiveness of those, but other countries have had much stricter controls on movement. Here, the state of Utah, for instance, was going to ask people from out of state to register with the local health authorities and check in about their temperatures and whatnot. And that drew so much blowback that they quickly withdrew it.
Wow. Rhode Island is such a tiny state. It'd be really hard for them, Alan, to stop people with out-of-state license plates, given how small they are. We touched earlier on the role that police find themselves in. And Alan, I wanted to quickly ask you how you have seen law enforcement authorities working with this around the country. You mentioned sheriffs earlier who didn't want to impose restrictions. What about police who have been tasked with this new role of sort of, breaking up games at basketball courts?
Well, a lot of people in law enforcement have contracted the virus due to the need to interact with the public. So we should acknowledge that they are at risk. And there have been sort of people kind of testing the limits of government authority and sort of the ways we're talking about. There's some well-covered cases, a hair salon owner in Texas who refused to keep her shop closed, a group of parents who went to a playground in Idaho looking to reclaim it and saying they had a right to be there. In both those instances, They were given multiple warnings. I think, as John was saying earlier, people are trying to have a light hand in enforcing these. People are offered warnings and things like that. And in both these instances, people seem to want to make a point, and so they forced a point until they were arrested. One other issue we've seen, and you know, a lot of coverage, particularly in New York, is disparate enforcement, where in terms of people actually arrested for not following social distancing or sitting in a park. Sometimes you're allowed to walk in a park, but not sit in a park, things like that. You see Black people much more likely to be arrested than.
Yeah, I saw some of those numbers reported by the New York Times, I think, in terms of enforcing social distancing and so forth. John, I have to ask you this. The playground example came up here in Concord as well recently. A family came to a park in Concord South End and said, we've got a right to play there. And there was a little, I don't want to call it a scuffle, but there was a confrontation with police. What are your thoughts about that, John?
Yeah, I read about that, you know, in the paper. And, you know, it sounds as though the police took a light approach in responding to it. And, you know, being a police officer is a very, very difficult job. And we hope that our police officers exercise discretion in ways, certainly, you know, I'm sure that, you know, superiors are giving directives about, you know, how light a touch they should have. But it does seem clear, you know, that this was a violation of you know, these advisory orders that have been issued. The police engaged these people, but no arrests were made. You know, everything is context specific. I think what we're seeing here locally, at least, is again, a commitment across the state to light touch enforcement, advisory enforcement. That, you know, that is almost certainly a consequence of public opinion and you know, political authorities trying to draw a balance, and so much of law is trying to draw an appropriate balance between competing interests.
Well, and we've talked about state versus federal authority, we've talked about states and their local communities, we've talked about police and how they enforce all this. We have not yet talked, gentlemen, about individual businesses and some of the rules and regs that they're putting in place and that they are trying to follow. We'll talk about that after a short break, and we'll keep taking your phone calls at 1-800-892-6477. Email us exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, government power, civil liberties, and COVID-19. What rights and limitations do government officials and individuals have during a public health emergency? We've been taking your thoughts on this. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. We're talking this hour with John Grabe, director of the Rudman Center for Justice, Leadership, and Public Service. He's also a professor of law at the UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law. Also, Alan Greenblatt, senior staff writer for Governing, a news outlet that covers state and local governments. You can find links to Alan's work at our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And both of you, we've got a couple emails from listeners who want to talk about the role of individual businesses. Here's Brian, who says, I believe many more businesses could have continued to operate. A shuttered art supply store could have admitted a limited number of patrons and required the use of face masks. There were too many arbitrary decisions regarding essential businesses. To you first, I think, John, what about the businesses requiring customers do this, that, and the other? Here in New Hampshire, you still can go to the drugstore and the grocery store and see some people still not wearing masks. So what rights do businesses have to say, you must do this?
Well, you know, businesses are not the government, right? So constitutional rights don't apply in the context of entering a business. Businesses do need to respect civil rights laws. And so if for example, they started discriminating on the basis of race or religion or something like that, they would get into legal trouble. But the default is that businesses can really decide for themselves how they want to do business. And I would expect that there would be broad leeway given to businesses if they wanted to be, you know, quite strict in imposing limitations on how they're going to do business with the public in terms of, you know, welcoming customers into stores and placing requirements on customers who enter stores, for example. You know, it's really first and foremost in the hands of the individual business to decide how to proceed now that we're, you know, taking this first step towards reopening.
Sure. Although, John, the governor has said, for example, hair salons that are opening, the stylist has to wear a mask and the customer has to wear a mask. So in some instances, the states are saying you have to do this, businesses.
Right. I didn't mean, yeah, I just meant insofar as additional legal obligations other than, you know, the emergency orders. Yeah, of course, that's right. There's conditions on the reopening that are imposed by the governor. And then what I'm suggesting is that on top of that, stores would have additional liberty to make, you know, to impose additional restrictions if they think that that's in the interests of the business and the interests of their customers, so long as they abide by, you know, basic civil rights laws.
I see. So they do have the authority or the leeway, John, to impose additional restrictions. It's their business and they can do what they want as long as they don't violate certain civil rights protections. That's what you're saying.
Absolutely.
Very interesting. Al, I'd like to get you in on this too. You gave us that well-known example of the Texas salon owner who said, I don't want to shut down. But Alan, what about businesses that have pushed back on state requirements saying, I want to put in more measures that feel important to me? What are you hearing on that sort of side of the equation?
You know, it's so interesting how opinions about certain things change depending on the politics of the moment. So a couple of years ago, you had conservatives defending this cake shop in Colorado, Masterpiece Cake Shop, that refused to make cakes for same-sex weddings, and the Supreme Court upheld that the business was not obligated to serve those customers as they wished based on the owner's own religious principles. So now you have more conservatives chafing at these restrictions if stores have one-way traffic in the aisles or if they require masks. As John points out, you know, we do have civil rights laws regarding public accommodations. We all recall that so much of the civil rights era was based on being able to sit at a lunch counter, being able to ride on an interstate bus, things like that. but for an individual shop, you know, if a customer is acting in a rude way, a loud way, things like that, I don't think anybody would question their right to say, we're not going to serve you. But people who refuse to wear masks are not a protected class in civil rights law. So certainly, and one more thing is that, you know, business owners also have an obligation to protect the health and safety of their workers. They, you know, this is going to be one of the big arguments in Congress is how much should businesses be shielded from liability due to this virus. But certainly they want to protect their workers who at grocery stores and hardware stores and like are at much more risk than the customers. So in terms of the balancing, I think John is correct that business owners will have more leeway than governments in terms of what restrictions they have within the four walls of their shop.
Interesting. Well, and as you might expect, we've got lots of questions from listeners about masks. Here's a question from our listener survey from Susan, who says, why doesn't New Hampshire fine people who are out but not wearing masks? Those of us who are older, Susan says, and more at risk, wonder at the numbers of folks who do not use face coverings or observe social distancing and suffer no consequences when we are at such risk, Susan says. She says it seems a $50 fine would inspire a lot more compliance and we would all be safer. Now, you guys probably know Massachusetts governor has made wearing masks in public mandatory with a fine of up to $300 for violators. John, can you kind of give us the legal analysis of these concerns and fines over wearing masks in public and so forth?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, it's a decision by political authorities you know, about how strictly they want to enforce these laws. And, you know, that is in response to, you know, their sense of how important it is to, you know, what are the benefits of a mandatory mask rule? knowing that that's going to trigger a backlash, and backlashes might even lead to, you know, greater disregard of laws than when, you know, the laws are merely, or when guidance is merely that, guidance. And so, you know, obviously Massachusetts has denser populations. It's got Boston, you know, outside of Manchester and a few other cities. Here in New Hampshire, you know, we tend to have more open space. And so different states have made different decisions, no doubt in response to public opinion. And in rooted in calculations about what is going to, you know, achieve the optimal level of behavior and social distancing. Sometimes you know you do better with a lighter touch in terms of inducing people to play along and to cooperate.
What have you seen, Alan, in terms of mask mandates around the country? I think they're mandated in Maine as well. This has raised, you know, some concern among people who say, hey, I don't want to wear this. Other people, like Susan, say people should be fined if they don't wear it. What have you heard, Alan?
Well, I think there's 6 or 7 states now that are mandating masks, at least in enclosed spaces. We should bear in mind that masks are required in every country that is having a successful fight against this disease: South Korea, Taiwan, Austria, so forth. In France, they have this interesting irony where they're mandating that people wear masks, but they still have a ban on women wearing burqas, the Muslim garb. But in general, like John was saying, sometimes a light touch goes a long way. You have a lot of governors who are not only wearing masks in public appearances, but they'll wear, you know, the emblem of the local sports team, things like that, to try to make masks more fun. And that's why there's been a lot of commentary when the White House is saying that people should wear masks, and yet President Trump isn't wearing masks in public, including during a visit to a mask factory. And the Vice President Mike Pence didn't wear a mask to the Mayo Clinic, although he later sort of apologized for that. The idea is that if you believe in it, you know, you should practice what you preach. And it's important for the public officials, if they think it's important, to demonstrate this behavior themselves. But again, like the point I keep making, other countries have much more strict regimes than we do. We're a much more individualistic, libertarian, liberty-loving country. And so sometimes you can make the point in gentler ways rather than with the heavy hand of a mandate or a fine. But we'll see. I think the question of masks is still open as we as cases continue. And if we get to a second wave, I think masks have been demonstrated to be pretty effective. So it wouldn't surprise me if there are more mask mandates, but we're obviously not there.
Yeah, sure. And in France, for example, during their lockdown, they could only go outside 1 hour a day, and you had to have some sort of note saying, I am going to the grocery store, I am going to the doctor's, and you could get a very hefty fine if you violated that. So you're right, Alan. We feel restricted here in this country, but it is a lot tighter elsewhere. I want to share an email from Gary in Newfield, who says, I'm a registered nurse working in the emergency room at one of the largest hospitals in New Hampshire. For those that say they have a right to not be wearing a mask when entering public buildings, I ask, where does your right to freedom of expression or freedom from tyranny conflict with my right and the right of other citizens and employees to be free from fear from contracting this disease? Gary says, unlike the alcoholic, the drug addict, the morbidly obese, the smokers, etc., COVID-19 positive citizens have the ability to infect others when they act as if their rights only matter. Gary, thank you, and good luck to you working in the emergency room as a nurse. Boy, John, this is a fundamental American question, isn't it? What's the saying? Correct me if I'm wrong. Like, your right doesn't, something about your right to punch me, or what is it?
Right.
Your
right? I was just thinking the same thing, but I'm
I can't think of it right now.
I'm sorry, but yeah. My right to extend my arm, you know, extends only doesn't so far as your nose isn't there or something.
That's
like that.
It. Thank you very much. Yeah, this is a fundamental aspect of our Constitution and our laws that Gary is asking. So thank you, Gary. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I mean, no, I mean, even the most extreme libertarian view would recognize that when one is exercising liberty in a way that then intrudes upon the rights of others, there is, you know, we have a problem. And so Gary makes a very, very important point. I think it's the problem is exacerbated by the fact that the contagion is invisible. And, you know, we live in an era where one can find, reporting that, is designed to reinforce what one wants to believe. And so people who think that this is all nonsense and it is all overblown can go find, media that and other writings that reinforce that idea. And so, you know, that's the problem. Gary, who's a nurse, understands that he understands how disease is transmitted and that this isn't a matter of just individual liberty on one side. The problem is that there are people who don't understand that this is a serious, serious virus, easily transmitted, and that and they don't trust really the information that's coming from government about the devastating consequences that this pandemic is having in this country and around the world.
Well, and transmitted even if you are feeling fine. We know now that many people are quote unquote asymptomatic, and so there is that. What do you think about that email from Gary? And again, Gary, thank you for writing in. Alan, go ahead. I'd love your thoughts, Alan.
Sure. I think this gets to historical amnesia and the way we deal with health in this country. So by historical amnesia, it's the point I made earlier, we haven't had a pandemic of this scope in this country for over a century. And we forget that at the beginning of the 20th century, 1900, communicable diseases like tuberculosis and diphtheria and indeed influenza were the leading causes of death in the country. And now it's almost all non-communicable diseases that mainly kill people. I mean, at the moment, COVID is the leading killer in the country, but typically heart disease, cancer, things that do not communicate from one person to another have been the leading causes of death. Even accidents and suicides are kill more people than most infectious diseases now. So we don't remember that all of this is based on we don't think about transmission, and the way our health system is set up, it's all about individual care. We spend a couple of pennies per dollar on public health. It's almost all care of individuals. All our policy debates are about insurance and who should be covered and who should pay for it. We really tend not to fund public health the way we did back in the days when infectious diseases were more of a threat. And so I think it's really a minority opinion, this idea that my right not to wear a mask supersedes your right to health. I think the polls show that the vast majority of people support most of the efforts that states are making. I agree with this point you're saying, that your rights only extend to the tip of your nose. And when they start interfering with me, then it's a different story.
Well, it's so interesting what you say, that, it's been so long since we've had outbreaks like this, that we don't, when we talk about healthcare, we don't really have a good concept of what public health is. We're so used to looking at this from an individual by individual by individual basis, Alan. That seems to be what you're saying.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's public health departments are typically underfunded, and, they're in a no-win position where if they're successful, we don't notice. And when they fail, of course, we do notice. You know, public health is just the lowest priority until it's the only priority. Wow. It is. And it speaks to this other point we're talking about with federalism, where, as I was saying earlier, it started at the local level, boards of public health, things like that, went to the states. We've never really had a federal Department of Public Health. We have the Centers for Disease Control, which only started in 1946 in response to a malaria outbreak, which is why it's in Atlanta. And typically in a situation like this, you would have the federal government setting the course in terms of the medical and scientific approach, and then it would be left to the states and cities to carry it out, maybe with funding from the federal government. Here we're having more of, where the White House has sort of veered between saying the president has the authority to saying it's up to the governors and we're a backstop. So we've approached this pandemic in a different way than is typical, but it's always the case that we have a very fragmented response where you have different approaches in different places, different amounts of funding in different places. Typically, it's not affecting the whole country at once, so we don't notice as much.
Right. Well, it has been interesting to watch sort of the states take the lead on this and governors assert their authority. Alan, it's been really good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Alan Greenblatt, senior staff writer for Governing, a news outlet that covers state and local governments. John Grabe, thank you also for being with us. We always appreciate it, and I'm sure we'll talk again.
Anytime. Thanks very much.
That's John Grabe, director of the Warren B. Rudman Center for Justice, Leadership, and Public Service. He's also a professor of law at the UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our executive producer is Michael Brindley. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our fellow is Jane Vaughn. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Thanks for being with us. I'm Laura Canoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.